Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. As the need to raise the debt ceiling in mid-May approaches, we will discuss the next budget hostage crisis with Randall Ray, Professor of Economics and Director of the Center for Full Employment and Price Stability at the University of Missouri. We'll also look into how cutting money from a sick economy makes no economic sense, yet due to the absence of an argument from the Democrats, the Republican narrative is dominating the discourse and driving the politics behind the deficit hoax. Then, as tax day approaches, Scott Klinger, the co-author of a report, Unnecessary Austerity, Unnecessary Shutdown, joins us to suggest reversing tax giveaways to the super rich that could erase the debt and end deficits. Then finally, we'll hear from an opposing argument to Juan Cole's critique of leftist opponents to intervention in Libya presented on yesterday's program. Professor of Politics and Chair of the Program in Middle East Studies at the University of San Francisco, Stephen Zunis, joins us to offer a defense of anti-interventionism in Libya. Let's turn to a discussion of the recent and next economic hostage crisis. I'm joined by L. Randall Ray, who is a professor of economics and the research director of the Center for Full Employment and Price Stability at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. He also writes regularly for the websites Benziger.com, New Economics Perspective, and New Deal 2.0. Welcome to Background Briefing, Randall Ray.
Hi.
And you were just in Bretton Woods, the site, of course, the famous post-World War II economic conference, and I take it the event sponsored by George Soros was also met by some of Glenn Beck's cheer squad, I take it. They were manning the highways and byways of New Hampshire?
Yeah, there actually were some protesters there.
So you are clearly a part of some devilish, monstrous underground plot to destroy American sovereignty.
Yeah, a little strange. We're hoping it'll be remembered as the second Bretton Woods conference, and I just wanted to correct you. It was sponsored by INET, which got its initial funding from George Soros, but
right.
It's sponsored by INET.
And he made gave an address there, a somewhat pessimistic one, I take it.
Yeah, well, quite a few people are pessimistic about the economy and the financial sector. I would guess that a pretty big minority, if not majority, think that we face a double dip and another financial crisis.
Well, we know we're going to have more of these budget hostage crises because they kicked the can down the road after this last threat to shut down the government was averted at the last minute over the weekend. And now we know that we'll have one coming up in mid-May when we reach the need to increase the debt ceiling. But I think you're talking about something beyond that, right? Because it seems to me that the whole idea of cutting money in a sick economy makes no economic sense. And is that what's going to cause a double-dip recession?
Yeah, I think the fiscal tightening, state and local governments, of course, have to tighten, and they are, and they're laying off workers, and they're cutting spending. They might even raise a few taxes and fees here and there. But what's more important is the federal government impasse, Washington budget-cutting hysteria. I think it's very likely they are going to cut some spending, even if we don't shut down the government. Of course, the reason the Republicans are holding the government hostage is because they're trying to get the Democrats to go along with large spending cuts. And as you're implying, the economy just cannot afford this. We can't afford spending cuts. We actually need spending increases.
So how did this so-called deficit hoax get foisted on the American people? It seems that, at least to my mind, one of the reasons it is continuing and growing in its momentum is it's due to the absence of an argument from the Democrats.
I think that's right. The Republicans, of course, have two reasons for whipping up the hysteria. One is that they would like to see the economy struggle. They would like to see the unemployment rate go up because they think that will help in the next election. The second reason is that they want to use the excuse that the government can't afford to continue on the current path to cut programs that they don't like, which mostly are the ones that benefit average working Americans. Now, why would the Democrats go along with this? This is where it gets just plain bizarre. I think that there are elements of the Democratic leadership that decided really all the way back in the Clinton years that what we need is a budget crisis. If you remember Gore, it was all about Social Security. And we create the crisis because then the Democrats can claim that they're going to save the economy and protect at least some of the programs that we got in the post-war period that benefited, again, average Americans. And so they went along with this and actually helped whip up the hysteria because now they can say, hey, look what the Republicans are trying to do to you. We're going to protect at least some of the programs. We're not going to completely eliminate Medicare, Medicaid, and Social Security. But, yes, we're going to have to cut them. And I think this is why we are in the situation we're in now.
Well, Randall Ray, it does feel a bit like a kind of economic form of the Stockholm Syndrome. In other words, the president and the Democrats get mugged by the Republicans, and as the Republicans walk off laughing about how much money they've lifted from their wallets, the Democrats say, hey, wait a minute, I've just found some extra change in my pockets.
Yeah, and, you know, once you've devoted so much effort and a whole decade to creating this belief that our federal government, which is the issuer of our currency, is running out, that it just doesn't have the money to spend anymore. And you get the population and the media and a lot of policymakers to actually believe this, where can it stop? We've got a budget deficit that's over $1 trillion, and that's mostly because Wall Street destroyed the economy. And to cut $1 trillion out of government spending really will lead to a Great Depression.
And of course, the $38.5 billion dollars in extra cuts that were extracted by the Republicans from the White House are on top of a $40 billion in additional spending that Obama proposed and then subsequently dropped. The Republicans certainly have the momentum, and they're already sort of threatening the next round as the federal debt ceiling is supposed to be raised sometime in mid-May. Why is it then that, you know, there are some people like Warren Mosler on Wall Street and others who are saying that it doesn't matter, either short-term or long-term. What are we talking about? The real issue now is to create demand in a sick economy and to give people money to spend. And I don't want to keep repeating myself, but where is the arguments for economic 101 going to come from so that we don't have to endure this farcical, nonsensical debate?
The economics is clear on this. There is no plausible economic argument for cutting government spending when you have unemployment, officially unemployment, near 9%. There just isn't one. So we've got down to politics and what Ryan says is morality. It is just immoral for the government to spend money on Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid because that benefits average Americans. That's immoral in his view. We ought to eliminate that kind of spending to provide the proper incentives for those people to go out and struggle more. It's a morality play. So,
yeah, but even if you can't, I mean, obviously that is bizarre. But Ryan is also saying things like, for example, America is facing a situation like Greece. And That is manifestly untrue, that Greece's situation is largely due to the fact that it's a part of the European Union. And you could make the analogy that California could become the next Greece because they're constrained in the same way that the Greeks are. But why doesn't somebody challenge not just so much the bizarre morality, but the actual facts and statistics?
Well, of course, there are people who are doing it, and it's not just economists like me and others that you have talked to, and you mentioned Warren Mosler, who, of course, is a financial markets guy and understands the way financial markets work. There are fairly conventional economists who do worry, I think, completely erroneously about the long run. But even they are arguing there's no reason to cut spending now. So the voices are out there, but the problem is that when you go to Washington, and I went there two weeks ago or so, and met with various policymakers outside government, trying to influence government, let's say, and they say, you know what you're saying. We completely understand the economics. They say the economic arguments make no headway whatsoever because this is politics. And until the Democrats see where this is driving them, I don't think we're going to get another side to the deficit hysteria. And unless the Democrats are challenged, not from the right, but from the left, by people who want to protect working Americans, where there is a legitimate challenge to this nonsense, I don't think the economic arguments are going to get a hearing or going to win this debate, unfortunately.
Again, I'm speaking with L. Randall Ray, who is professor of economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. But in Congressman Ryan's plan for the 2012 budget, he's talking about reducing the top tax bracket down to 25%, which a listener pointed out to me is actually a reduction from 39.6% to 25% is, in fact, a reduction of 35.35%. And, of course, as we know, the big earners, the hedge fund managers, only pay 15% as a capital gains tax because of their carried interest. And that would be, by the same standard, a reduction of from 39.5 to that'd be a 62.12% reduction. And that's current law. So here we are a few days away from tax day. You'd think that the average Joe out there who's having to pony up real money and a much, much, much more than 15%, you'd think they'd be outraged.
Yeah. And of course, it exposes the representatives in Washington, in both parties, as hypocrites. Because if you really are that worried about budget deficits, you don't give tax cuts to people who aren't struggling. I mean, the top 1% it has the biggest share of income they have ever had in the United States. They're benefiting just fine. Even in the aftermath of the crisis, their incomes are going up. It makes no sense whatsoever if you're trying to reduce the budget deficit to give them more tax cuts. So, again, it makes it clear. It's not an economic argument. It's politics, and Ryan and Republicans are playing to their true constituency, which is the richest of the rich.
But in hoodwinking the American people into believing that these short-term spending cuts are good for the economy and that the long-term goal is to reduce the deficit, how long before they... You mentioned earlier, Randall Ray, there's two possible there's a possible subtext here that they don't want things to get the economy to improve, so that the Democrats and Obama lose the 2012 elections. But How long before do you think this irresponsible wrecking crew? I mean, we went through the foreign policy wrecking crew of George Bush and Dick Cheney, and that was bad enough. But this is in plain sight the wrecking of an economy, an economy undergoing an anemic recovery. And you'd think that the president would be fighting mad because his political fate is on the line.
Yeah. You know, Naomi Klein has called this shock doctrine, and this is probably the best example of shock doctrine that has ever been put in play. They are using the crisis to implement what would be politically extremely unpopular policies at both the federal level and the state level, taking advantage of a supposed crisis of the budgets when that crisis, of course, is created by Wall Street crashing the economy. So, you know, the good news is we are seeing people rising up and saying we're not going to take this anymore. The one good thing that I got out of my trip to Washington was meeting with people involved with labor unions, and they said, you know, we had done a poll and found that the popularity of labor unions was at a 50-year low 1 week before the events in Wisconsin. After the events in Wisconsin, it was at a 50-year high. And so I think that there still is some chance that this shock doctrine is not going to work, because people are starting to realize that what they're taking away is a middle-class living standard. If this goes through, we're not going to have an American middle class. It's already been squeezed tremendously, but it just won't exist after this.
Well, you know, even people like Warren Buffett have warned that we're heading into a plantation economy. It may well be that since our system is based on money, and the Supreme Court now has basically said, allowed politics to be entirely about money, he with the most money has the most political advantage. That it's that simple. Maybe there are people that feel that way. But just in closing, again, in terms of we're mad as hell and not going to take it anymore, how could they also be now gouging us, these same people that we rescued on Wall Street, with gaming the price of basic commodities like food and oil, gasoline, which people are really feeling at the pain at the pump? There's a huge speculative bubble involved in it, and that is completely unproductive. I talked to Michael Greenberg about it the other day, and yet I don't hear everybody's saying, oh, it's because of Libya. Hogwash, it's not. Speculators are driving up the price. Just as in the conference you just attended, they talked about how speculators are distorting the Brazilian currency.
Yeah, that's right. We saw the same thing in 2008. And Stupak and Lieberman led investigations, and the managed money, ironically, largely pension fund money, got scared and they pulled out. And you remember in the fall, or August and fall of 2008, the price of oil fell from $149 to $49. What happened is that because real estate markets are, of course, still declining, there really are only two things you can put money into. One is commodities and the other is the stock market. So it's not surprising at all that since the crisis, commodities and stocks have gone back up. And it is purely a speculative boom. You know, there's no reason why the stock market should be going up when you're in a deep recession and recovery really has not gotten underway. And as you're saying, it's not demand for commodities and the little blip of Libya on the supply side that's driving up commodities prices. It's speculation. It's because there just isn't any other game in town that's going to get you a high return that's expected by managed money. So they've gone into commodities, and this will crash again. But
in the meantime, Randall, they are bleeding the average working stiff every time he shows up at the pump. I mean, these are the people who rescued these guys on Wall Street.
Yeah. So Americans are losing their jobs, taking wage cuts, losing their homes, and paying more for food and energy. We're squeezing them again. We did all of this in 2008, and that's how we got the crisis. So every factor is back in play, and real estate prices are even much lower than they were in 2008. So we're right there on the precipice of another collapse, and that is what is scaring a lot of the people who attended that conference.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today in Los Angeles, Dr. L. Randall Ray.
Thanks a lot.
I've been speaking with L. Randall Ray, who's a professor of economics and the research director of the Center for Full Employment and Price Stability at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. He also writes regularly for the websites Benziger.com, New Economics Perspectives, and New Deal 2.0. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with the co-author of Unnecessary Austerity, Unnecessary Shutdown. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, and I'm now joined by Scott Klinger, who is one of the authors of the report published by the Institute for Policy Studies called Unnecessary Austerity, Unnecessary Shutdown. Scott Klinger is an associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies and the policy director for Wealth for the Common Good. He is a chartered financial analyst and previously worked as a security analyst and portfolio manager for Walden Asset Management. Welcome to Background Briefing, Scott Klinger.
Thanks so much, Ian.
And we were talking earlier with Randall Ray about the deficit hoax and how the Republicans are essentially controlling the narrative and that the Democrats haven't created a narrative. Do you think there is, given the failure of our political leaderships, do you think there is a way to, since the public are being gouged at the pump because of speculation in commodities, it doesn't make any sense to cut funding and spending on an anemic economy, which should be stimulated, not reduced at a time which is likely to cause a double dip in inflation, a double dip recession. All of the writing's on the wall that these guys in Washington are not just screwing us, they're screwing the economy. Where's the pushback going to come?
Well, we wrote this report to really fill in some of the blanks of history of how we got to this point. And the point of this report is the taxes have really been shifted off of the wealthiest Americans and off of the largest corporations onto the middle class, really over the last 50 years, but especially over the last 20 or 25 years. And so the revenues has not at all been on the table in this discussion about our budget, and we really think it needs to be because hundreds of billions of dollars can be raised by just restoring some of the tax giveaways that have been given to the wealthiest and the largest corporations.
And you argue in your report, Unnecessary Austerity, Unnecessary Shutdown, that if you just taxed the rich fairly and also made the corporations pay their fair share, you could raise $4 trillion within a decade, and that would be a huge way to solving the problems, which, by the way, I think it's worth noting, surely, Scott Klinger, that the two Bushes, Bush Jr. and Sr. and Ronald Reagan, are responsible for half of the entire national debt run up in the entire course of the Republic, and George W. Bush was responsible for one third. So you don't hear that when all these deficit hawks are crying about how the United States is turning into Greece.
And what President Reagan and the most recent President Bush have in common is that the reason both of those debts went soaring was because of large tax cuts for the wealthy.
And why is the debate in this country, though, shifted to this notion that we're too taxed too much, which is the excuse they give to reduce the tax for the super wealthy, when the debate should be about what you get back for your taxes, surely?
For sure. And one of the reasons we wrote this report was to really look at the historical record and say, you know, are the wealthy really taxed too much? And so we looked at the period 1961 to 2011, that 50-year period. And what we found was that in 1961, the people with incomes over $1 million in 2011 terms adjusted for inflation paid 43% of their income in federal income taxes. This year, they'll only pay 23%. So they're pocketing 20% of their income that used to go to support the society they live in. the situation's even worse with corporations. Large corporations used to pay more than 47% of their income in federal corporate income taxes. Last year and this year, they'll pay about 11%. So they're pocketing 36% of their income that used to go to support the services they depend on for their earnings. And the other thing that we haven't really talked about is it shifts onto small businesses. Small business owners pay taxes at their owner's individual tax rate, so usually typically 35% or so. And so they're really getting all the things they face in terms of competing with big box stores and other large entities. They also have to pay for those companies' tax burdens often.
And it seems to me that you have to add to this the idea that we have certainly, starting with Reagan, but certainly accelerating under George W. Bush, created a kind of society for inheritors and investors. And so much of what goes on in Wall Street is unproductive in terms of Main Street. Wall Street's about extracting wealth, not creating wealth for Main Street and for small business. So you have this situation where all of this speculative money now on Wall Street, as our previous guest indicated, is driving up the price of basic commodities like food and gasoline.
Absolutely.
To no productive end.
Right. Well, one of the prescriptions we call for in this report is a financial transaction tax, which would be a small, essentially a sales tax on stock and bond purchases, commodity purchases, currency transactions. It would exempt small investors investing in the stock market. It would exempt people engaging in currency transactions to go on vacation to Europe, et cetera. But the UK already has this tax in place. It's not hurt their financial markets. And not only would it control some of the speculation you were just talking about, but it would raise about $150 billion a year for the Treasury. So that's another idea, another way that Wall Street can help share some of this burden.
Well, I suppose it's worth figuring out where people can put their money, since real estate is out because of what happened with the subprime crash, and apparently the choices now are the stock market or gambling in commodities. You would think, though, that you could that in terms of the purpose of the mercantile exchange, that they would restrict the commodity gambling to the end users. So in other words, people, you know, oil refineries should be the ones that are speculating or hedging,
right? Or airlines, or people that use the
product. So couldn't there be some law passed to get all of this $50-60 billion of unproductive money? That's because we know it's eventually going to crash,
right?
To get it out.
Well, one of the things, I think that's one of the ways tax policy has been used, is to discourage unproductive behavior. We have taxes on, alcohol and cigarettes, in part to raise money, but in part to discourage excess consumption of those things. And the same thing could be done with speculative transactions using the tax system. If you're buying jet fuel, or if you're buying for an airline, you're buying stocks, you know, with a 5 or 10 or 20 year horizon, a very small transaction tax isn't going to discourage you from making that investment. You won't even notice it. But if you're trading, you know, flipping your portfolio every minute or every day, then that transaction tax is going to be a speed bump in the road to your speculative behavior.
So in other words, now we have Goldman Sachs making a big chunk of their profits from these high-speed computer trades that they do,
right.
And that they've actually moved their computers physically so that they're right next to the stock exchange, so that
right. They
get that millisecond...
Taking advantage of the speed of light.
Exactly. And that is not just unproductive, it's also totally shuts out everybody else from the market. I mean,
right. This
is a... Doesn't this look like a rigged casino?
All the rules are tipping to favor those that already have wealth.
Right.
Whether it's the lower taxes on capital gains that we see, and that's one of the big reasons why the rich pay lower taxes, is because their capital gains only pay a 15% tax rate, which is lower than most middle-class families pay. So Warren Buffett's very troubled when he says that he pays less of his income in taxes than his administrative assistant, and it's because most of his income comes in capital gains. So that's another loophole that we need to close, is to tax capital gains as ordinary income and begin to restore some of the balance that rewards work and not just speculative behavior.
Again, I'm speaking with Scott Klinger, co-author of the new report, Unnecessary Austerity, Unnecessary Shutdown. So, Scott, do you think that the president is going to talk about this on Wednesday? He's supposed to be doing a major address on taxes and on tax reform.
Right. We've heard that he's going to bring up that the rich need to be taxed more, be able to pay more of their fair share. And so we're anxious to hear what he has to say and hope that he will stand up strongly about this. And if we're going to address things like spending, we need to also look at the revenue side of the budget.
But isn't what you've sort of been saying, or at least hinting at, Scott, that systemically we have changed the economy entirely and the mechanism of capitalism to favor the oligarchs and to shut out in any kind of fair and competitive way the average investor?
Right. Well, we had a much more equal society in 1960. For sure, we had some major social problems pertaining to racial disadvantage and the Vietnam War and other sorts of things going on. But in terms of economic inequality, it was much less than it is today. And one of the reasons was the tax system, because the highest tax rate was 91%, the personal income tax rate. The corporate income tax rate was close to 50%. So there was no incentive to make $100 million because you only got to keep a dime of every dollar you made above an equivalent of $3 million today. So we didn't have these inflation things. You talked about speculation earlier, but when we have rampant inequality, we have people that are owning 3 and 4 and 5 houses. That was part of the bubble too.
I recall John McCain didn't even remember how many houses he owned.
How many houses he had, exactly. And so that bids up the prices, right? You see these places where the price goes up very, very highly, and people that actually live and work in those communities can't afford to live there because, you know, often sometimes people coming in on weekends have the weekend places that bid up the properties and make it unaffordable for the average worker.
So do you think that a government of the people, for the people, and by the people is possible, or how do we go back to that?
Well, I think the issue of money in politics is an enormous issue that we need to remain totally focused on, because Congress is doing the bidding of those who pay for their elections, and sad to say, I think it's true of both parties. And so until the people demand that we have caps on spending, that corporations don't have free speech rights, I think we're going to go down this path, unfortunately.
Well, I thank you for talking with us today, Scott Klinger.
Thank you very much, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Scott Klinger, who is one of the authors of the report published by the Institute for Policy Studies called Unnecessary Austerity, Unnecessary Shutdown. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with a scholar, Middle East scholar, who will give a rebuttal to yesterday's argument by Juan Cole in favor of intervention in Libya. Now let us turn to the United States and its NATO allies' intervention in the Libyan conflict and get a critique from Dr. Stephen Zunis. He is a professor of politics and international studies at the University of San Francisco, where he chairs the program in Middle East studies. He serves as a senior policy analyst for the Foreign Policy and Focus Project of the Institute for Policy Studies. He's an associate editor of Peace Review, a contributing editor of Tikkun, and chair of the Academic Advisory Committee for the International Center on Nonviolent Conflict. Welcome to Background Briefing, Stephen Zunis.
Good to be on.
And yesterday I spoke with Juan Cole, who was arguing against, or at least giving a critique of a part of the left in this country and in Europe as well, that opposes the U.S. and NATO intervention in Libya. And, of course, I wanted to get another critique. So just in brief, what is your fundamental argument against this intervention?
Well, what it comes down to, I think, is that this is not a humanitarian intervention. This is not... We're not doing this to prevent a massacre. I am not opposed in principle to the idea of the responsibility to protect. I don't think that national sovereignty should protect a tyrant. if they're engaged in genocide or mass slaughter or that kind of thing. But I really have not seen clear evidence that this was transpiring or about to transpire. I mean, there's certainly war crimes, but going on, but no worse than the kinds of things that have been committed by some of America's closest allies in recent decades. But rather, the issue here is whether the United States should be taking sides in a civil war. And I'm dubious, despite the fact my sympathies are definitely with pro-democracy forces in Libya. I definitely would love to see Gaddafi gone, as do most people. But the whenever the United States and the Western powers gets involved in the internal conflicts in a Middle Eastern country, we found it it's been a lot more complicated than many people suspect. And the other problem, I think, is that, I think the movement in Libya initially started out as sincere and broad-based and legitimate as the pro-democracy struggles we've seen in Tunisia, Egypt, Yemen, Bahrain, Syria, you know, any number of other countries, that as it has become primarily an armed struggle, some pretty sketchy characters have risen to the top, including people who were in Gaddafi's cabinet until a few weeks ago, including one fellow who's worked closely with the CIA for quite a few years, including some radical Islamists, people whose commitment to democracy is rather questionable. And finally, my big concern is that one of the remarkable things that we've seen in these pro-democracy uprisings elsewhere is that they were genuinely indigenous and popular movements. This was not, despite accusations by the dictators of one thing or another, these were not inspired by foreigners. These were not about somebody else's agenda. These were legitimate struggles for freedom. And whereas this does seem a little more like an old-fashioned foreign intervention for a particular faction that is frankly not being as successful. Because here's the other thing that's really important, is that the Libyan movement was doing better when they were nonviolent. That's when they liberated most of the country. That's when you had all these high-ranking defections from Gaddafi's inner circle, from the military, foreign ambassadors, even mistresses. I mean, all people were, it looked like his days were numbered. But when they went to armed struggle, they challenged Gaddafi on his strongest point. And one of the paradoxes that people don't realize, and empirically this shows the case, that even when you're battling brutal dictators, nonviolent action tends to be at least twice as effective as armed struggle in terms of defeating the regime in question, because you're able to mobilize a larger sector of the population. Defections from security forces are far more higher if they're being ordered to fire into unarmed demonstrators than if they're being shot at. The foreign intervention has brought in the whole nationalist card, and Libyans are traditionally quite xenophobic. That's played into Gaddafi's hands. So just even putting aside some of the legal and moral and ideological questions, purely on a pragmatic level, armed struggle, especially with foreign intervention, seems less effective if the goal indeed is to get rid of Gaddafi.
Well, Stephen Zunis, let's start with that point, because I did recently speak with Gene Scott, who is the intellectual godfather of all of these nonviolent struggles, particularly the Egyptian one, and starting with Otpor in Serbia, and all of these young revolutionaries in the various Arab revolutions have in fact been inspired by Gene Scott. But when Gene Sharp. Yep. Yes, what am I talking about? Gene Sharp. When you say though that the nonviolent revolutionaries who took over most of Libya then went to armed struggle, my recollection of what happened was they took over the place. The Gaddafi and the sons were sort of keeping their powder dry. And they warned them, and they said, "We're going to just crush you like cockroaches." And when they decided to crush them like cockroaches, a professional army routed these nonviolent protesters and drove them all the way back to Benghazi very quickly.
They did not drive them back anywhere. The Many tragically were killed, and people, and many were arrested. But this is not like a standing army where people will advance and retreat. You know, quite the same way. Now, often when people think of nonviolent action, they think of these, thousands or hundreds of thousands or whatever people massing in a central square and whatever. And in some cases that can be effective. But just like in guerrilla warfare, there are times for frontal attacks, there are times for so-called final offensives or whatever, and there's time for tactical retreat. There's time for diversification of tactics. There's time. One needs to think strategically. And that was the problem with the nonviolent struggle in Libya. It was not that it was nonviolent, it was that they didn't think strategically. We've seen in Tiananmen Square being one of the most well-known cases of a nonviolent movement that clearly overplayed their hand and did not have the strategic and tactical innovation to deal with what they were dealing with.
But how do you deal with tanks and armies with loaded guns? And
remember, hundreds of people were killed in Tunisia and in Egypt. Thousands were killed in nonviolent struggles in other countries.
But I saw the guy with the Chinese guy with the briefcase standing in front of the tank. That was inspiring. But I saw the bodies of hundreds of these young kids.
Oh, yeah. Again, they made a tactical mistake of all massing in the central place and essentially calling for the abolition of the whole system before they made alliance with the workers to go on strike, for general strikes before, diversifying their tactics for a longer term struggle. And this is the equivalent of a guerrilla army calling for the a final offensive before they have built up their base in the liberated zones and et cetera. Again, it comes down to strategic and tactical questions.
But doesn't it also have a lot to do with who you're up against? I mean, you could make the argument, surely, Stephen Zunis, that what's common throughout all these uprisings in the so-called Arab Spring are that these young Arabs throughout the Middle East are aspiring for a better life and more opportunity and more democracy. They have all that in common. They're very tech-savvy, and they're very up on what's happening in the world. The difference is the extent to which the people they're up against, the dictatorships they're up against, are prepared to be ruthless. And my question to you is, surely Gaddafi and his sons, there's no limit to their ruthlessness.
That's true with a lot of tyrants. I remember Marcos and Milosevic and even Ben Ali is now on record specifically ordered his troops to massacre protesters by the thousands, and they refused. And in some cases, like in Mali, the uprising against Traore in 1991, the military did initially shoot into crowds, killing many hundreds. People kept coming back, and eventually the army mutinied because they couldn't do that anymore. There's too much dissent within the ranks. The reason that Tahrir Square did not turn into Tiananmen Square was not because Mubarak was a nice guy, but because it was pretty clear that the rank-and-file soldiers did not obey him. I mean, look at Suharto in Indonesia. This guy has more blood in his hands than virtually any late 20th century dictator outside the Khmer Rouge. Yet he was overthrown, a largely unarmed insurrection, simply because, again, you couldn't trust the loyalty of his forces. So it's not a matter that Gaddafi is more ruthless than the others, because we've seen a nonviolent action work even against ruthless regimes. And indeed, there is this effect that Gene Sharp refers to as political jujitsu. I think probably Aikido would be a better analogy. But when the force of the regime is used against them, when they do take up that kind of force, so. There are any number of complex reasons why a given struggle doesn't succeed or succeeds, but I don't think simply the ruthlessness of the regime is necessarily the key variable here.
Well, it seems to have been the deciding facts on the ground in terms of driving the revolution all the way back from Tripoli, all the way back to Benghazi.
That part took place after they took up arms.
I understand, but there's never been any symmetry. All you have to do is look at the pictures of these kids in jeans and sneakers and T-shirts, with some gun they found somewhere up against
And that's why I'm saying, yeah, I'm not making a moral judgment against
right.
people who do that. I wouldn't make moral judgment against any people and oppressed people who feel a need to take up arms. I'm not a pacifist. This is not a value judgment here. This is just in terms of tactically and strategically. When you don't have an armed, well-trained armed force, then you're going to be in bigger trouble than if you can take advantage of your numbers, you know, through massive non-cooperation and other forms of resistance. Which again,
would that have worked though with when NATO intervened? Gaddafi was on the doorstep of Benghazi, and he and his sons said that they were going to get retribution. And you say at that point, had they not resorted to armed struggle, there'd be no civil war. The other argument would be that there'd be no more rebellion. Yeah, sure, the civil war would be over. That's because he would have wiped them all out.
Yeah, and it's possible. You know, I'm not, you know, and again, I'm not opposed to this idea of a humanitarian intervention in principle. But again, we've seen this is not what it's about right now. For example, Gaddafi has now agreed to a ceasefire. Now, if I was the rebels, I would accept the ceasefire. I would consolidate the control of the liberated areas, should have a model of good governance, and start strategizing for massive non-cooperation, general strikes, and other ways to undermine Gaddafi's power in the remaining areas. But since they feel, NATO's got our back, we can keep on fighting. Now, if this is truly simply a matter of responsibility to protect or humanitarian intervention, and why isn't NATO encouraging the rebels to accept the ceasefire instead of keep on fighting? You know, clearly more people are going to get killed on both sides.
Well, I'm pretty convinced that this whole NATO exercise has little to do with its stated aims. This was the best deal that they could get, given the reluctance of the Arab League and the opposition of the African Union. So the subtext is to get rid of Gaddafi. I don't think there's any doubt about that. And frankly, just as in terms of a strategic analysis of it, nothing they're doing makes any sense, unless you do get rid of Gaddafi and his sons. Otherwise, that explains the inconsistency to me. It's just that nobody, including Obama, is prepared to speak truth to that. But both you and I were big supporters of the Sandinistas back in Nicaragua in the 80s, and of course against the hideous murderous government in El Salvador that the Reagan administration supported. And I'm just trying to make analogies now between the idea of the Sandinistas People Army that we were so enamored with, fighting against a dictator that we found so abhorrent. Why aren't we enamored with this manifestly clear citizens' army up against an even more ruthless dictator with tremendous amounts of money, more than Somoza could ever dream of, hiring Belarusian mercenaries? One of the sons has his entire army is an army of mercenaries.
I certainly wish, I would love to see Gaddafi overthrown. My concerns again are, one is that even though it is indeed a popular revolution, I'm less enamored with some of the people in the leadership. I think the resistance by the Afghan Mujahideen to the Soviet invasion and occupation was legit in principle, but 80% of the arms the U.S. sent to the Mujahideen ended up in the hands of the Hakmakhtiar group, which the Hezbollah Islami, which is an extreme fundamentalist, misogynist. These guys are aligned with the Taliban now. Unlike nonviolent struggle, where by its very nature you need to build broad alliances, broad coalitions, it brings about the better elements of civil society and pluralism. In armed struggle, you get this elite vanguard. With these martial values, which is much more likely to turn into another dictatorship or end up fighting among themselves. The Sandinistas certainly had their factions, but they were pretty relatively unified group compared to this motley assortment that's in Libya. And again, my fear is, with going to the armed struggle and with U.S. intervention, it is not leading to the rise of the more legitimate democratic elements, but rather just the opposite.
But, Stephen Zunis, the Sandinistas were supported by the Cubans and by the Soviets. And...
Yeah, no, that's fine. But there's a limited amount of small arms that went to them. It was nothing close to the air power, the massive air power that is coming in from NATO. I really don't. There was not right. any direct intervention by Soviets or Cubans.
But of course, at this point, there's a lot of military analysts suggest that, in spite of NATO's firepower, they're not going anywhere. This is this could be fought to a standstill because
exactly, and that of course has its own very issues of concern, potential partition of the country, and all sorts of other things. And again, that's why I believe that they'd be more successful if they accepted the ceasefire and returned to a primarily nonviolent strategy, which could be a protracted struggle as well, but not nearly as fraught with the dangers I fear in foreign intervention and war.
Well, I guess the two scenarios then, just in wrapping up here, Stephen Zunis, is that one, they would have been wiped out and Gaddafi would have presided over a victory, and then eventually there'd be some revolution against him. Now there's a revolution that almost succeeded but was turned back by his superior firepower. And you're suggesting they now that they've fought to a draw, they ought to just take the best deal they can make.
But don't stop there. Don't stop there. That's when you re-escalate the nonviolent struggle, and then again form a genuinely democratic model in the liberated parts of the country that the rest of Libya will want to emulate.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today in Los Angeles, Stephen Zunis.
My pleasure.
Again, I've been speaking with Stephen Zunis, who's a professor of politics and international studies at the University of San Francisco, where he chairs the program in Middle Eastern studies. And this has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I would like to thank my producers, Spencer Downing and Kim Nassiter. Our theme music is One Time, One Night by Los Lobos. You can hear this program, sign up for podcasts, and contact me at ianmasters.com. If you've heard something you like, something you don't like, any suggestions or tip, let us know. We read every email. You can also check out my blog. Go to ianmasters.com and click on blog. Bye for now.